All right, everybody. We are back on the podcast with my favorite guest of all, Matthew Good. Matt, welcome.
How you doing?
Much better now that you're going to give me a second shot at this.
So basically, instead of costing me $40 today, it's going to cost me $80.
Dude, do you want me to call you?
I just
signed up for, I get Canada for 5 cents a minute.
Nice. You think I've got some kind of ridiculous plan.
Okay, good.
I haven't checked in a long time.
Because,
I can't tell anymore, I'm so damn hot. I'm actually wandering around nude.
You're hot right now? It's 8:50?
Oh, man, it's boiling.
You don't have windows open or air conditioning?
Oh, yeah, well, see, I live in a perfectly round building, so my windows are floor to ceiling in my apartment, because my apartment is, like, it's one side of it is grounded, right? So the way that it was built, as ridiculous as it is, there was only windows at the bottom of these floor to ceiling windows that are only about a foot high, or half a foot high.
Right,
and they open a little.
They figure that you would use air conditioning when it gets
hot. See, this is the interesting thing. In British Columbia, in the Lower Mainland in general, air conditioning is not something most people have. Unlike in LA.
Right.
The West Coast just doesn't. It's not like the East Coast. We don't do the air conditioning.
That's true.
So, you know, and usually here in old apartments that I've lived in, primarily in the West End of Vancouver, you know, it's all 50s three-floor walk-ups. So you got nice big windows that open, and you know there's always a breeze here, so the wind comes in. And no, modern buildings, no.
So people just sweat it out in the month or two that's super hot.
Yeah, I mean basically, I really don't know. I think in the last 4 or 5 years, the weather in this town has gotten far less predictable than it used to be. I mean, it used to be the case that from June pretty much till near the end of September was really good weather, and we'd have like a couple, you know, maybe a week all told of bad weather in the summer. And then in the winter, it would basically rain from October to April. You know, just we're obviously known for our rain.
Well, you have a heater for the winter because it's Canada.
Wow, it's no colder here than it is in Seattle.
We don't know what that is.
It's exactly kind of the same thing. So, it doesn't snow here.
It doesn't?
No. If it snows in BC, like in, not in, I shouldn't say in BC, because in places like Kelowna and like in the Okanagan and up north, it snows like nuts. But that's also in the middle of the Rocky Mountains or in the Coast Mountains. But in Vancouver, I mean, we're in on the ocean, right? No, it doesn't really snow. It snows in the mountains, which of course you can ski, you can leave downtown and in 15 minutes be on a ski hill. But we're at sea level. So, and if it snows downtown, this whole town shuts down. I mean, buses are slamming in the building. it's kind of despicable, considering that the rest of Canada is quite cold, usually, and it snows quite a bit, yet, and everyone can drive in snow very well, whereas, the majority of people, you know, people who live in the Lower Mainland can't drive in snow to save their lives. Rain, yes, I can hydroplane with the best of them at 100 kilometers an hour, not a problem. Driving snow, not going to happen.
Very interesting. What kind of car are you driving these days?
I bought a used blue car. I have a blue car. I got it used. Actually, the interesting story about my car is that...
I know a kind.
Yeah, a consumer... It was the Consumer Reports test car.
Like, they actually physically used that one?
For 3 days, and they bagged it. I test drove it, so it was a year old, it was used, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I test drove it, and the clutch was just gone. Like, they had just kicked the shit out of it. So I came back into the dealership, and I said, well, the clutch is gone. And the guy's like, well, is it really? Like, let me check. So they put it up on the hoist, and no, sure enough, the clutch was completely shot or close to it, and it was just really loose. And so they put a new clutch in. Yeah, I got a bit of a steal of a deal on it.
That's great.
Yeah.
Now, does Matt Good Rockstar, does he just walk into a dealership and just get love from everybody? Are you that well recognized in Vancouver?
Well, interestingly, the first I didn't own a car for years. First car I bought was $500, like back when I was like 18 or 19 years
right.
old, and it was the driver's side door was duct tape closed, and I had to climb into the passenger side. It was the 1979 Plymouth Sapporo. And then after that, kind of bit the dust, I got a 1980 Chrysler LeBaron.
Oh.
The big kind of Honduran family living in the trunk.
And no extra charge.
And it just floated. And I had that for about a year, and then I moved in with a girl and was an idiot, and so we could afford to move in, sold my car, and it was, anyway, it was ridiculous. And then forever I didn't own a car. I walk, you live downtown in Vancouver, you walk everywhere, you don't really need a car. If I ever move my gear, I got a, you know, a friend to help me, or, you know, later in my career, people move your stuff for you, so you don't, you know, I don't really, didn't really need a car. So when I finally actually went out to go get a car, which, you know, I don't even know why I went to get a car. I just thought one day, you know, because my parents moved out way out of town, I thought, well, I get a car so I can go see my mom and dad more. And I just thought, okay, I'm going to go get a sensible car, you know? So I went to Toyota, right? Because I lived right across the street from Vancouver Toyota. I walked across the street, like this is 1998, I think, 1999. Walk across the street to Vancouver Toyota. I walk in, and I'm looking at like this Corolla or something, right? And for the life of me, I cannot get a sales representative to come over to me. Right, I'm wearing combat pants and suede boomers and a t-shirt.
Yeah.
Right? And, you know, I look unkempt. So, no one would come over to me. And I basically ended up having to go and find a sales representative. And I'm not saying that it was busy. The place was not busy at all. And these guys were just sitting at their desks, ignoring me, right? So, you know, I'm standing there, and I'm kind of like, I really want some information on this car. Like, what kind of gas mileage did it get, the rest of it. And I actually had to go bug a guy. And basically, the long and the short of it was, is I went, you know, I went from looking at this Corolla over to looking at a Toyota Supra, right?
Right.
And this guy's giving me the whole nine yards about how I can't afford a sports car like that, and one day maybe I'll be able to.
Meanwhile, your song is probably playing on there.
By that time, I think at the time that I did it, I mean, my third record had come out and gone platinum in a month or something like that. So, you know, I mean, I had some money. I mean, that's not to say that record sales equate, especially in Canada. I mean, it's, you know, it's not like the United States. You sell a million records in the United States and, you know, you're making huge money just off publishing in Canada. It's not really the same.
Right.
But, yeah, I mean, I had enough money to buy a car. And I wasn't even going to buy it. I was just going to lease it.
Uh-huh.
Right? And, yeah, he gave me the whole runaround. I was very discouraged.
He was talking you down off of the profitable car for him.
Well, kind of not talking me down. I think he just eyed me up and realized that I was like, you know, there's certain customers, I guess, that go into car dealerships that people know are a waste of time. Or they think this kid's a waste of time. He's not seriously going to buy a car. So, you know, maybe someone, you know, maybe some other person will come in that looks like, you know, like a better catch.
Right.
So, you know, I just said fine. And I walked across the street. And, you know. And then I ended up asking a friend. I said, listen, I need you to find me a guy that can help me get a car. You know what I mean? Like, you know anybody that knows anybody that knows about these things? You know? And I think one of the main reasons at the time that I wanted it was, you know, to basically write a little bit of money off.
Oh, right. For taxes.
Yeah, for taxes. Even though at the end of the day, it became kind of a pointless exercise, but... You know, I think I did something really stupid at the time because I'd never owned a new car in my life. I had grown up with all, you know, used cars. I mean, when I was a kid, we had a 1963 Plymouth Valiant,
and
a 1971 Plymouth Valiant. I mean, my dad, you know, was Mr. Valiant. Then we got a station wagon, I think, in the 80s sometime when my dad owned, like, a small coffee shop, and, but, I mean, you know, the 63, I remember going to school in that, and it was, like, rusted out, and it was pretty hairy there. My mom despised driving it because, she thought the floorboards were going to seriously give way with us in the car, and the only way you could drive it in the summer was to have the heat full on so it wouldn't overheat.
Oh, man.
So it was horrible, and, you know, so... I decided, you know, well, let's talk. I'm going to talk to this guy and see what his best advice is, right? So he starts launching into this whole routine and diatribe with me about, well, getting an economy car or getting, like, a mid-range car at like, Ford or Chrysler or Toyota, really, in a monthly payment scale, is not a whole lot different than getting a luxury car.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I went and looked at everything, and then I wound up at places like Mercy Mercedes-Benz and BMW. And the BMW I ended up at was actually in Coquitlam, where I had grown up. And it, one thing led to a fuck another. I don't know what the hell happened. It's like one of those things, you've never had a shiny toy in your life, and, you know, and I tell you the truth, I regretted it, like, the day after. But I ended up getting a really rare BMW that I think there's like 100 of them in Canada. It's called an M Coupe.
Uh-huh.
315 horsepower two-seater. Like, ridiculously fast car. And I got this car, and I took it back. I went home, and I didn't drive it for 3 days. I actually was sick to my stomach, because I thought to myself, if anyone I grew up with saw me now, I'd have to kick my own ass.
Right.
You know, I mean, because I grew up in kind of, you know, the economic surroundings where we made kind of fun of people.
Right.
Cars like that, right? So...
And so here you are buying this flashy car in your hometown.
Yeah, and so I got the car, right? So on the fourth day, and I shit you not, this is a true story. I drove that car out of my underground parking lot, into the alley, hung right in the alley, hung right on the Burrard, pulled a Huey, parked right in front of fucking downtown Toyota, went and banged on the window. I got the guy's attention, and I said, look, I bought a car.
Very nice. But kind of the underlying question that I was asking was, did that guy finally realize who he was, who he'd blown off, though?
I don't think at the time. I think now I probably get far more recognized by most people.
Because you're a tall guy. I mean, you're it's not like you're this average-looking dude.
Well,
there's not a lot of Matt Good lookalikes walking around.
In Vancouver, people are very cool. I mean, we have a lot of film here.
You're right, right.
And that kind of thing. Like, you can walk down the street and, like, literally, who did I see the other day? Who is the main, pardon me, I can't even remember his name. Who is the main guy in Jurassic Park?
Sam Harris?
Yeah, wicked ass.
Yeah.
I wasn't looking where I was going, I ran full into him. And you wouldn't even know, right? You wouldn't even know. I mean, I really wanted to say, dude, you were awesome in Hunt for Russell.
Right.
But you wouldn't really know. I mean, you walk down the street in this town and Robin Williams goes by.
But you're the local guy. You're the Canadian rock star guy.
When it comes to these things, there's kind of two different things. There's people who will come up to you and ask you to sign something or shake your hand and meet you, and that's all, and that's perfectly all
right. Right.
And then there's what's called the eyes.
Ooh.
Where you can just tell people are looking at you.
Oh, the eyes. Uh-huh.
You know, like when you're in buying milk or something, people are just looking at you. You know, or they'll walk by you and look at you and look down right away, something like that. So that happens quite a bit. But for the most part, it's, you know, no. I mean, you live a pretty normal life, and I've always abhorred celebrity. I really don't. I've been always very uncomfortable with that and that kind of thing. So, you know.
But I hear what you're saying, but I would think when you're buying the car, man, that's the time to pull out the card.
Yeah, I mean, obviously when I was buying the car, that first car, I mean, well, I leased it. I didn't buy it anyway, so. But when I was getting it, obviously they knew who I was, but that doesn't get you any perks or nothing.
It doesn't? You'll get a discount?
Oh, Christ, no. Not in a car like that, there's no bloody way.
Because it's in such demand and it's,
well, it's not even
rare.
No, it's not that it's even in demand or rare. I mean, I ended up eating shit on it trying to get rid of it. And I lost a whack of cash getting, because it turns out the guy that turned me on to the deal got me into a lease that was just freaking horrible. And I couldn't get out of it. I had to eventually get a four-door car because we have dogs and the rest of it, right? The family thing, I need a car that makes sense. And I lost a ton of dough getting out of that car. And then I mean, when I left the showroom with it, it had like 20 kilometers on it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I only put 16,000 on it the entire, like, 2 years or a year and a half. I owned it.
Mm-hmm.
Some jackass from Toronto bought it. It's a rear-wheel drive car.
Right?
And with that kind of horsepower, it takes it on the road in Toronto, the ice wraps around a telephone pole, totaled it.
Oh, he did?
Oh, completely. He ended up in the hospital. He totaled the car.
Oh, man.
Like, the first day that he got it.
Wow.
So, that was the story of that. And,
maybe the states were looking down on you.
Well, no. I would hope not. I wouldn't hope someone else would get in a car.
No, maybe they said, hey, man, we need this guy. We don't need the jackhole. Let's let him get rid of that car.
No. The reason was, he was in Toronto, and there was ice on the street.
Oh, right.
You don't take, I mean, I went around some corners. I mean, the car handled like it was on rails. It was unbelievable, right? It had such, the torque and the horsepower in the car were so crazy that you could, like in the rain, you could throw the back end. And the back wheels were actually wider than the front wheels. You could throw that car.
You know, I'm not a big fan of Beamers, but I think they've done better as time has gone on.
Well, it really depends. I mean, if as far as pure car enthusiasts are concerned, it really depends on what kind of BMW you get.
Yeah.
I mean, if you can go out and just buy like a 3 or a 5 or a 7 series or now the 6 series, and that's like one thing, you know, that's one thing. But, you know, the real secret weapons that car company has are the M's.
Right,
three, and especially the M5, which of course is the fastest sedan in the world, or one of them. I'm sure that the A8, the Audi A8's up there and stuff. But I mean, you think about it, it's a 4-door car with 500 horsepower. That's a monster of a car. But I mean, really, you know, it's like anything. Why do you need that? I mean, if you live I live in a huge city. You know, why do you need a Ferrari? The only reason you drive a Ferrari is because you have a penis the size of a circuit. Why do you need that? What, are you going to take it on the Zenith Sky and just 250K? I don't think so.
Well, I mean, I guess my bias comes from the fact that I used to pump gas at an all full service gas station.
I worked at a gas station forever too, and that's it.
And after a while, you knew as the guy, you know, came in, who was going to be a prick to you and who wasn't. And it was almost always the Beamer guy.
I mean, I make no mistake. When I got that car, I drove to Coquitlam and went to the gas station where I worked.
So. Right. Oh, yeah.
You have to do it.
Yeah.
I mean, you just have to do it.
But then you tipped the guy pretty good, though, I'm sure.
Hmm?
You tipped the guy?
Well, actually, it's all self-serve now.
Oh.
No one was waiting on me.
That sucks.
You know, I mean, I don't really know. I don't use the car, really, to be honest with
right,
you.
Right, right.
Jen drives it like 99.9% of the time. I don't really. She was just in an accident, actually.
Oh, no.
Right before we saw you.
Oh, that was that accident.
Yeah, she twisted her pelvis.
Right.
She's being physio now for like 2 years or some ridiculous
thing.
Oh, no. Like that. And, yeah.
Did she have her lap belt on?
Oh, yeah.
Because I was told that if you just have your top belt, that you can get in a serious accident, or a serious injury.
There's only one way you can put the belts on.
Good.
It's shoulder and lap. It's all,
good.
It's all one. It's all
good.
One thing. So, but, you know, the car had to get whole, totally redone. The whole front end was fucked. And
it sucks.
It had to be redone, but whatever. I mean, I walk everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everything I kind of need within my general vicinity, my general neighborhood.
Right. Okay, well, I think if we haven't lost all of our listeners, I think...
I mean, really, because... being nude.
That's right, you're still nude, for the ladies out there.
Still completely naked.
Okay, and I'm in my pajamas, so... So there we are. Okay, so let's try to see if we can have the same friggin' conversation we've tried twice already today.
Okay.
But of course we'll do it differently, because we're both ADD or whatever. The topic of the week, last week, since this will probably come out on Monday night, is payola. Did you get a chance to look at that up at all?
No.
Or are we still flying by the seat? Okay, to recap, Sony Columbia,
Sony BMG.
Does Sony own BMG now? Or are they two different labels?
Yes, I believe Sony bought BMG.
Okay.
Maybe it was the other way around. No.
It's so hard to keep up.
Anyway, whatever.
But they're the same damn thing now.
Yes.
Just like, so it's Sony, Columbia, Epic.
There's a whole bunch of labels under the parent umbrella.
Right.
Like Warner has a whole bunch, and like just like Universal has
Geffen.
Yeah, etc.
Okay. So they are under investigation for payola, which is paying off radio stations to play songs.
Yes.
Which is illegal.
Yes.
And
though, like I pointed out this morning, there is a, you know, there obviously is a way they've been doing it for, you know, more than two decades or for a long time now, in that they'll get bands to basically play free radio shows.
Right.
Like radio festival shows or whatever.
Before we get to that, let's just go to the straight up.
Okay.
We're going to pay you $4,000, which was one of the examples in the lease information.
Or a vacation, or, well, yeah, whatever.
Right. We'll pay you money, give you a vacation, or give you some CDs or concert tickets or whatever, if you play this particular artist these many times. So one of the examples was that they got something like, I don't know, 300 spins of Franz Ferdinand at this Buffalo radio station for $4,000. Now, could you explain why that's illegal? If it's business, why can't you pay for that?
Well, because, I mean, there's supposed to be obviously a separation between, you know, well, art and commerce in one respect, and second of all, the fact that, you know, music's supposed to really make it on its merit. I mean, if that were the case, then, you know, I mean, you could sign four acts to your label, spend all your money on them, and basically just pay radio to play, you know, absolute bullshit. And, you know, I mean, artists would have no power.
Right.
Because the label could just find, the most meat-headed, you know, malleable guys or girls that they could possibly get, which really, you know, we're not far from now anyway. And, you know, and they could basically just pay radio to spin it until it dropped dead. And, you know, and then, you know, what say would an artist have in the creative process? What say would an artist have in anything? I mean, as it is now, artists have very little say in a lot of things to do with their career. I mean, like I said before, it's really important to remember that payola exists, especially in the United States, because in Canada you get paid to play most radio shows and the rest of it,
right.
I mean, or at least I have in my career. In the United States, it's not uncommon for a new band with a new CD out to, say, play a radio festival, let's say in San Francisco, and then have to, you know, get on the bus and go all the way to St. Louis to play a free radio show there. And the only way that they can afford to do that is through tour support from their label, which, of course, they have to ultimately pay back.
And tour support is the label says, hey, we will pay for your bus ride to St. Louis.
We'll pay for all the expenses for you to tour. See, the problem is that if you don't end up selling records, you're just in the hole. And if you don't end up selling enough records to pay all that back, which in a lot of ways is a significant amount of records that would be needed to pay all that money back, you basically live in debt.
Right.
I mean, you go, say you're lucky enough to even get these days to a second record. You get your advance, and you just live off your advance, but you owe that advance money back as well.
Mm-hmm.
So it just becomes this huge, insurmountable, you know, sum of money that you'll never in a million years pay back. Unless, of course, you sell a considerable amount of, you know, several million records or a million records, and you can actually pay back a massive marketing fund, a massive amount of advances, and if your deal is, you know, some of your marketing fund or whatever. I mean,
and what's interesting are there are some acts like Jane's Addiction, I think, is the latest that I was aware of, who, even though they did do pretty well in their short career, still owed the label so much money that they had to sell Coming Down the Mountain to Coors to pay off their debt.
Probably. Well, the thing about it is in that situation, they obviously wanted to get off of the label.
Right.
See, now, a label can drop you, and you don't owe them a dime. If they decide to just basically kick your ass out the door, you don't owe them a penny.
Right.
They'll still own the recordings, and you'll own your publishing, obviously, if you've written stuff or whoever wrote it. But they'll own, you know, they'll own the masters to whatever you've recorded. You know, and you won't owe them a penny. And, of course, among several bands that of my acquaintance that I've known over the last 15 years, they've made quite an art of having zero career and zero success, but just going from a big record deal to getting kicked off the label and, you know, scoring a huge deal to begin with, and then becoming the buzz band again and getting another huge deal and getting, you know, from deal to deal to deal.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, ridiculous as well. But, you know,
labels wake up to that after a little while.
Oh, sure.
And they're just not going to sign you this fourth time.
Well, sure. I mean, it depends on who. I mean, you could be with one label, in New York, another in Los Angeles, one in Toronto. It really just depends on who you're working with. I mean, hands, you know, the ship changes hands a lot in this business, and
that's true. And so the guy that signed you 2 years ago might have jumped ship to another label and still believes in you and signed you again.
Very true. I mean, in my case, I don't really know, because I've had the same A&R guy my whole career.
But there's like guys like Danny Goldberg who have now been to like three or four major labels, and, you know, he still believes in certain bands.
Yeah, I worked with Danny. He signed me to Mercury.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, but that was, he signed me to Mercury, or basically, actually, interestingly enough, his wife saw our video on Much USA and liked it so much that he ended up calling up to Canada, because it was an affiliate label at the time, because I was on A&M, which is Polygram,
mm-hmm.
saying, who is this guy? My wife loved him.
Wow.
And basically from there, it was all systems go in Mercury, And then, unfortunately, that was on Underdogs. And then, unfortunately, that's when the rumors of the Polygram Universal merger started up. And the whole world, if you were a Polygram artist or a Universal artist at certain levels, the whole world froze over.
Right.
Nothing moved.
Nobody got signed.
Yeah, and because of that, I mean, I was already signed in Canada, so it really didn't matter. But actually, Underdogs for me in Canada was still, you know, my own record. I owned the album, and it was licensed through A&M. But as far as doing anything in the United States with Mercury at the time, it ended there, then and there.
Right.
And
what year was this, approximately?
That was like 98, 97.
Okay.
So yeah, I mean, you know, that ended there. I mean, I've had a lot of ill-fated experiences with American labels. That have shut down after I've ended up on them, or there's been a merger, or, you know, it doesn't matter. But anyway, let's get back to payola.
Okay, let's do. Okay, so it's illegal because it not only does it screw everybody over as far as artists go, there's no artist say, but really it's like a commercial now. This, I mean, not that it wasn't in the first place, but it's truly a commercial because you're paying for their airtime. And it's a lie. It's deceitful.
Yeah. I understand what you're saying. I mean, I guess if you looked at music from purely, you know, from purely a commodity standpoint,
yeah.
Sure, why the hell wouldn't you pay a DJ to spin a song a quadrillion times?
Well, no. I'm not going that far. I'm saying if you're going to do that, say, okay, hey, this hour is sponsored by Polygram. These are Polygram's newest stars, and this is the Polygram Hour. You know, but is that even legal?
No, not from what I understand. I think that still constitutes payola.
Right.
I mean, really, at the end of the day, you're talking about an industry where artists, for the most part, I mean, obviously people always argue this point because they're like, well, J-Lo's worth $1 trillion. I mean, for the most part in this business, most artists, you know, the artwork aren't millionaires, and they're low man on the totem pole financially.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you look at any other form of entertainment, whether it be in the arts or in sports, everyone makes huge bank.
Right.
At the professional level. Right?
And they get to keep it.
Well,
it's not a loan. So, like, if you're a new band and you get a million-dollar deal, you don't get $1 million.
No, correct, no.
But if you're LeBron James...
A small amount of that will be maybe your personal advance, and the rest of that's your recording budget.
Right.
And then another part of it will be, what their commitment to marketing videos, or if there are videos, and et cetera, and so forth.
Right.
So when someone says they signed $1 million deal, it's not I just got $1 million in the bank.
Right.
And that's extremely rare anyway.
Oh, it is.
I signed my first publishing deal for something like $16,000.
Holy mackerel.
Something like that. I mean, my first record deal, was nowhere really near those kinds of stuff.
And you still had to pay your manager and your agent off of that $16,000?
When you go out on the road, your manager gets 20% of everything,
uh-huh.
Right? And then and then your agent, when you're on the road, gets 10 to 15% of your live royalties.
Uh-huh.
Not your live royalties, but basically, you know, what you make a night.
Right.
So there's 30 to 35 gone off the top whenever you tour.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
and you got to pay the band.
Think about back in the day. Of course, obviously, tour support. So, you know, I've been lucky because I was an independent success before I signed a record deal. So I never have asked for tour support from my label. I've always been able to float my own boat.
Right.
So,
so like when huge bands like U2 go on the road, they're paid. That's their show. That's their company on the road. The label's not helping them out because they don't need any help.
No, they don't.
Right.
No, they don't. But, I mean, that there's also a reason why their tickets are $70, right?
Yeah.
I mean, they bring a schwack load of people. That kind of show requires so many people, and you've got to transport them all,
mm-hmm.
and just all the rest of it. It's ridiculous.
Right.
I can't believe it. I mean, I was talking to someone the other day, and what are Stones tickets going for now?
Well, but this is their last show.
Who cares? Last time was their the time before fucking that was their last show.
The only
you're gonna pay like $200-$300 to see 60-year-old. I mean, don't get me wrong, I love the fucking Stones.
Are you going?
These 60-year-old dudes running around?
Are you gonna go?
No.
It's still Mick Jagger, man.
So what?
It's 60 years old. He can still kick both of our asses.
Well, I'm sure he can.
I
just paid $300 to see him.
Have you seen him before?
Don't you?
Well, okay then. So, yeah, me and you, we probably won't. Actually, I may, because I'm a freak. And I love the fact that I have to sit down in the middle of the slow songs while Mick is still up there shaking his ass. It gives me inspiration.
Well, I mean, it's cool. It's just that I just don't, you know, I mean, listen, if you're going to be a big touring band or whatever, I understand inflation and the rest of it, you know, maybe 50, 60, 70 bucks, sure, for, you know, I don't know, but,
well, but that's
when you're talking multiple hundreds of dollars for one concert,
it's just like, you, it's a night in the town in L.A., man.
You better get a T-bone and a blowjob. I mean, I don't know.
Well, because you got to buy two tickets, so you better be getting one from the other ticket holder.
I don't know. It's just,
my problem with you
is just crazy. That's crazy. I mean, think about that. Think about it. I mean, but then again, people, you know, playoffs, people spend that $500 to see a playoff.
That's right.
So, I mean, who am I to say anything? You know, if it's on TV, why not just watch it on TV?
Right, right.
You know, I mean,
but
then again, I can't say that about football because, you know, the last, I guess, when was it, 2000? Or maybe, you know, it was in the 90s. I can't remember what year it was, but us and... It came down to the last game of the season between us, Arsenal and Manchester United.
Oh, you mean soccer?
Yeah, I was in England at the time, and I think I shelled out $600 Canadian to go to this game that, depending on the outcome of our game at home at Highbury and theirs, they were playing Spurs and we were playing Liverpool. We drew 1-1, and they beat Spurs 4-1, I think. So they ended up winning the league, and we finished in second place. But I think I paid at where was I? Maybe I think that there's like I think at Piccadilly, there's a like a scalper's booth or whatever.
Uh-huh.
I think I paid like $600 Canadian,
which is in American 400 American.
Yeah, I'm not, I'm not sure what it was, basically like 250 pounds.
Mm-hmm. So, 500 American.
So the Canadian dollar is, you know, like what, 230 on the pound or 240?
Yeah, who knows? You paid a lot of money.
Yeah.
But I think it might be a little different in sports because, and not to knock music, because you know I love music, but in sports, that's it. That game, that's it. You know, U2 goes on tour, you know, yeah, it's special, it's magical when you're there, but you really can get the DVD and have a decent idea about what's going on.
Oh, totally.
But playoff game, championship game, if you're there, man, that's it. You're the man.
Oh, I'm not disagreeing.
But now, here's my problem with U2's charging so much money. I see it two ways. First, the first way I see it as a capitalist, which is if people will pay $100 and you can sell at that freaking place, knock yourself out. Okay?
You know, my main thing about that is, and let's just leave this whole conversation alone.
Uh-oh.
It's when you're worth tens of millions of pounds. I'm sorry. Like, how much? I'm one of those people that it's just like, if you have enough money to comfortably live,
yeah,
and make sure that your family's future is secure,
mm-hmm,
how much fucking more money do you need?
But if the scalper's going to turn your $20 tickets into $200 tickets, why should the scalper get $180?
I don't know, so he can feed his family.
Well, maybe, but I'm torn there, you know?
That's not the point. There's always going to be scalpers, man. There's all, even for if there's 200, I mean, go to any play Vancouver Canucks playoff game.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to be sold completely out.
Mm-hmm.
And there's always, if the tickets were $300, there's always going to be some scalper selling it for $7. It doesn't
right.
matter, and that's even with two periods.
But wasn't that their rationale when Clear Channel started owning these stadiums? Isn't that what they said, that because of eBay and because it's so much easier to scalp, we just figured out what the value was?
Yeah, like listen to the huge fucking monster corporation trying to justify scalpers are ruining everything.
Yeah.
Like you're talking about, interestingly enough, about this whole payola thing about, you know, a radio station that sets playlists for most of its stations and it's probably going to be at the center of this entire thing.
Let's hope.
Probably own a plethora of stations that are involved.
Right.
So, you know, it's the same thing as trying to say that Ticketmaster is out there for everyone. You know, it's ridiculous.
Right. Right.
It's absolutely ridiculous.
Yes.
And, you know, the more I exist in a profession where so many fucking jobs have been created to steal from people who ultimately are the ones with the talent who actually produce art, that it is stunning.
Right.
It is absolutely stunning. From people people answering the phones at Ticketmaster to XYZ, you name it. There are so many people in my business that if every artist that had a backbone went on, every member of the union, the musicians union, went on strike tomorrow, like, I mean, if we actually got together and weren't greedy for 48 hours, you know, if all those guys that love, you know, that were, you know, that were too much gold or, you know, would miss their Bentley, actually decided to grow a fucking conscience and we all decided to go on strike, do you know how many people would be out of work? More people that went on strike.
Right.
Absolutely. Probably by several times over. Everyone at radio, everyone at retail, marketing, people in independent promotions.
Right.
Jesus Christ, man.
The vendors at the venues.
Yeah, ticketing, tons of stuff.
Parking dudes.
All based on, you know, the majority of people who, you know, who basically busted their ass, you know, the majority of them that are really kind of worth it, that busted their ass usually under the worst possible circumstances just so they can play music for a living.
Right.
You know, and these are not all people. I mean, despite how the media spins being a musician, you know, this whole idea of, well, you're so lucky to be a musician, you know, it's my dream. Well, you see, it's not my dream. It's just intrinsically who I am as a human being. Some guys become heart surgeons because they're talented at it. I became an artist. It's because it's who I am. It's because since I was a child, it's who I was. Whether it was writing or fine art or the fact that I played the violin to picking up a guitar at the age of 20, going to art school, it doesn't matter. It's when I, as a person, am down and out, I turn to art. I write. I create something.
And you just happen to luck into it. If there wasn't money and blonde chicks,
still do it.
You'd still do it.
Still doing it.
In the olden days, you'd be a courtesan for the king.
Yeah, exactly. You'd be in somebody's employ, and they would take care of you rather well, or moderately at least, and you would have a safe, you know, a decently secure life. I mean, artists have been fucked over centuries.
Right.
Centuries upon centuries, which is ironic, I think, because when you think about the first two achievements of any great civilization, there are always, the first two are,
I'm sorry, what's again?
The first two achievements of any great civilization are always what? Military achievements?
And science?
Artistic.
Artistic?
Oh, absolutely. What do you remember about the Romans more, or the Greeks? More, I mean...
Oh, you're right. Okay.
Talk about soccer. I mean, obviously, their contributions to mathematics and to other sciences were definitely significant. But you think of their philosophers.
Mm-hmm.
You think of, you know, I mean...
And their sculptors and their painters. Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, you know, you look, I mean, when you think of Michelangelo, or pardon me, Leonardo da Vinci,
mm-hmm.
Do you think of the fact that, you know, he's one of the first people to map the human body? Or do you think of the Mona Lisa?
There you go.
I'm not saying that all great societies, obviously, you know, I would definitely say predominantly you remember the military achievements of all nations.
Right.
Beforehand. But if someone were to say to you, the United States of America... The first thing that would obviously pop in your head would be, you know, war.
You think so?
Yeah, and the second thing wouldn't be wouldn't be scientific, I don't think. It would be something like Jimi Hendrix.
Right.
You know, it would be art.
Or Elvis.
Yeah, or Elvis. I mean, you would think of them first.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and these are things, the things that move us emotionally are what we gravitate towards.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and yet, like I said, you know, I exist in an industry where there's so many people that exist off of people such as myself.
Right.
I just find it ironic. I find it very much a mirror of a lot of other structures in our society.
Mm-hmm. Now, how do you feel about, like, bootleggers of your merch and stuff?
Well, I don't really dig. I don't really dig when people bootleg merch. I think that's kind of wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, that's somebody just basically making money off of you.
Right.
You know, and I don't really think that's cool. I mean, I got enough people making money off of me.
Right.
And, you know, at least the majority of them actually do work.
Right.
To justify it. Someone who does no work except for make fucking shirts.
Mm-hmm.
No, that's not cool. If fans trade bootlegs. And let's face it, most bootlegs sound like crap.
Right.
If they trade bootlegs on the net and stuff, let them.
Really?
Well, sure, let them. That's cool. I don't mind that.
So you believe in, like, the dead and fish and stuff? Like,
sure, why not?
You'd have a taping center or a taping area if you could?
Well, you know, I mean, people just, you know, you come in, you do it, I don't need to know about it kind of thing, but, I mean, there's obviously limits. If you got a fucking VCR camera, you know, you got a digital video camera, and you're taking, like, footage of the whole concert, yeah, I got a problem with that, you know?
And I think things are a little different now than...
Not really, let me state that it's not necessarily that you're going to go make tons of money off it, but it's because I didn't artistically approve it myself, which would be more my concern.
Right? That you sounded bad or something?
What?
That you sounded bad on their tape?
That it would, you know, if someone were to film a show, that it would sound bad, that it would look terrible, that it didn't really capture what I was trying to get across. You know what I mean? Like,
And you know what? I think it's funny. After knowing you for a little short period of time, just based on your blog, I know how much you toil over your friggin' blog, right? I mean, we talked about this just about an hour or two ago, about how you're going to change the whole look over again and stuff. I mean, you truly are somebody who cares about how things look.
Oh, absolutely. I definitely have OCD. And music's the same for me.
Uh-huh.
You know, I mean... So
I guess what I'm trying to say is I'm defending you and saying he's just not bullshitting you. You know, really do care about how it looks.
Absolutely.
And sounds.
The devil's in the details, man. I mean, you know.
Right.
That's what, you know, the sum of something is only, you know, its parts are far too important.
And that's because
that for me is the joy in it, man. Like, that's the joy in it, right, for me, so.
Mm-hmm. Right. And that's because you're afraid if somebody sees this bad bootleg video who's never seen you before, they're going to think, oh, Matt Good sucks.
Well, no, it's just because I didn't have artistic control over it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I didn't go, well, this is cool. I mean, what songs did I play? You know what I mean? Or if I were going to make a video, would I want to play those songs?
Mm-hmm.
How would I structure a set list if I were going to do a video,
mm-hmm.
a live video? You know, not only that, do I get to choose what the cover is or how it's presented to people?
Right.
You know, am I in charge of what, you know, I don't like one. I don't have fucking my hands all over.
Are you familiar with the Replacements bootleg cassette called When the Shit Hits the Fans?
No.
This guy bootlegged one of their shows, and they caught the guy, like, near the end of the show, and it was one of their drunken sloppy, really sloppy shows, but it was also one of their greatest shows, because a lot of times, those were the ones that were awesome, because they really did take requests, and sometimes it was miraculous. It was like a wonderful train wreck that was on flames.
Awesome, man.
Yeah. And a couple days later, they listened to this tape that they took from this guy, and they were like, hey, that was a pretty good show for a bunch of drunkards. And so, Twin Tone Records, which I guess is now defunct, which broke, Husker Du, Soul Asylum, and Replacements, Goo Goo Dolls also, said, well, it is a bootleg, and the sound quality is good. Let's not make it a record, let's make it a tape, because back in those days, you could just reel off a couple thousand tapes, and it wasn't a big deal. That one turned out awesome. So I guess that's what you're saying. Because the Replacements had artistic approval, maybe they cut out a song or two, and they were able to make the cover and get you the feel of this live album, you know, in the sense of a tape, then it's kosher.
Yeah, I mean, you got to remember that when it comes to just fans enjoying things, I mean, that's one thing. The, you know, the majority of people that are your fans are going to go out and, you know, are going to come to your shows again, and are, you know what I mean? And they really actually quite care about your input into things. Like, they want to know how you go about things, what your justifications artistically for going about things are.
Mm-hmm.
And that's awesome. I mean, when I was younger and in my favorite band, that's totally how I was,
mm-hmm.
you know? But there are also, unfortunately, those people out there that believe they're owed something. You know, and you run into them that are just like, I fucking buy your records.
Therefore,
you should come cut my lawn. You know, or there are people that actually believe that you owe them something for going and buying your fucking record. Well, I'm sorry, Your Royal Highness.
They don't see the deal as
you bought my record.
Yeah, they didn't see that was the deal. You pay me the money, you get the record, and we're even.
Well, that's right, because, of course, what's on the record doesn't justify you actually my part of the bargain, my part of the deal, right?
Right.
The fact that I actually have the ability to write music,
yeah.
that you couldn't write, or, you know, because if that were the case, then obviously I'd buy your record, you know.
Right.
And, you know, obviously you can take me, certain people obviously would think I suck and would never buy one of my records, you know, but obviously there's probably in bands out there that they love that the same thing would apply to. But you wouldn't believe how many people that I've met over the years or that have emailed me angrily and talked about, well, you can't treat your fans that way because without us, you're nothing. And that's like the most dangerous thing to say to someone who actually does this because, you know, because they have to, you know, because it is what they are.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what do you think they're going to fucking go, well, oh no, I better placate, you know, your needs because without you, I'm fuck all. What a great way to live your life, eh? Without everybody else, you're done for, you're cooked.
Right.
Because God knows you'd never pick up a guitar and just play. And who gives a shit? I mean, if you end up playing for yourself and recording at home, I mean, I think that's one of the great joys of, for example, like Apple's GarageBand. You could sit at home and make your own fucking records. And I mean, literally sit at home, strum your acoustic guitar, record it into your computer, put some drums to it, some bass guitar with a keyboard, or if you have a bass guitar, you can add some piano, or you add whatever you want. You can sing the whole deal, put it right into iTunes and burn a CD, or put it right on your iPod, you can listen to your damn self.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know...
And it sounds pretty good.
Well, yeah, sure. Sure, I mean, for the novice, hell, even for demoing purposes, to just get an idea quickly down, it's absolutely fine, you know? But, I mean, at the end of the day, I'd rather do that and listen to my damn self. Let my wife listen to what I've done, or give it to my, you know, my mom. And fuck money. You know, because he's home, because without him, I'm nothing.
Right.
You know, screw that, man. That's just so, I mean, how more slapped in the face do you have to be in this business?
So how are you about taking requests? When people scream out songs in concert, do they do that at your shows?
Yeah, they do, but it really depends, right? Because our shows are usually extremely fluid.
Mm-hmm.
So then, and you know, because we go in and out of songs, like, seamlessly sometimes.
Right.
We'll stop something and we'll go directly into something else. So usually we stick pretty much to the set list for that reason. Largely for technical reasons, right? Because, you know, if we'll trigger something or we'll be doing something with keyboards, right? If Rich starts playing a keyboard or triggers a keyboard patch or something, you know, it's to start a song, like to, you know, have like an ominous sound happen or a whole note or something like that that will lead into a tune.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we don't, or a sample, like say for example at the beginning of Giant, like the Cheerleaders or something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, then no, you can't really, you know what I mean? You can't really simply stop.
Right.
It doesn't really work. You know, not that, I mean, we absolutely could. I mean, you know, it's four guys playing, but, you know, when we kick into something like Near Fantastica, obviously that the looping sound at the beginning of that song is you know, coming off a disc because it can't actually be played.
Right.
So.